which the memory, rather than the understanding, must retain, had almost produced a schism among the Catholic bishops. The tome of Leo had been respectfully, perhaps sincerely, subscribed, but they protested in two successive debates that it was neither expedient nor lawful to transgress the sacred landmarks which had been fixed at Nice, Constantinople, and Ephesus, according to the rule of Scripture and tradition. At length they yielded to the importunities of their masters. But their infallible decree, after it had been ratified with deliberate votes and vehement acclamations, was overturned in the next session by the opposition of the legates and their Oriental friends. It was in vain that a multitude of episcopal voices repeated in chorus, "The definition of the fathers is orthodox and immutable. The heretics are now discovered, anathema to the Nestorians. Let them depart from the synod. Let them repair to Rome." The legates threatened. The emperor was absolute, and a committee of 18 bishops prepared a new decree, which was imposed on the reluctant assembly. "In the name of the Fourth General Council, the Christ in one person but in two natures was announced to the Catholic world. An invisible line was drawn between the heresy of Apollinaris and the faith of St. Cyril, and the road to paradise, a bridge as sharp as a razor, was suspended over the abyss by the master hand of the theological artist. During 10 centuries of blindness and servitude, Europe received her religious opinions from the oracle of the Vatican. And the same doctrine, already vanished with the rust of antiquity, was admitted without dispute into the creed of the reformers, who disclaimed the supremacy of the Roman pontiff. The Synod of Chalcedon still triumphs in the Protestant churches, but the ferment of controversy has subsided, and the most pious Christians of the present day are ignorant or careless of their own belief concerning the mystery of the Incarnation. Far different was the temper of the Greeks and Egyptians under the orthodox reigns of Leo and Marcion. Those pious emperors enforced with arms and edicts the symbol of their faith, and it was declared by the conscience or honor of 500 bishops that the decrees of the Synod of Chalcedon might be lawfully supported even with blood. The Catholics observed with satisfaction that the same synod was odious both to the Nestorians and the Monophysites. But the Nestorians were less angry, or less powerful, and the East was distracted by the obstinate and sanguinary zeal of the Monophysites. Jerusalem was occupied by an army of monks. In the name of the one incarnate nature, they pillaged, they burnt, they murdered. The sepulchre of Christ was defiled with blood, and the gates of the city were guarded in tumultuous rebellion against the troops of the emperor. After the disgrace and exile of Dioscorus, the Egyptians still regretted their spiritual father, and detested the usurpation of his successor, who was introduced by the fathers of Chalcedon. The throne of Proterius was supported by a guard of 2,000 soldiers. He waged a 5 years' war against the people of Alexandria, and on the first intelligence of the death of Marcion, he became the victim of their zeal. On the third day before the festival of Easter, the patriarch was besieged in the cathedral and murdered in the baptistry. The remains of his mangled corpse were delivered to the flames, and his ashes to the wind, and the deed was inspired by the vision of a pretended angel, an ambitious monk who, under the name of Timothy the Cat, succeeded to the place and opinions of Dioscorus. This deadly superstition was inflamed on either side by the principle and the practice of retaliation. In the pursuit of a metaphysical quarrel, many thousands were slain, and the Christians of every degree were deprived of the substantial enjoyments of social life and of the invisible gifts of baptism and the Holy Communion. Perhaps an extravagant fable of the times may conceal an allegorical picture of these fanatics, who tortured each other and themselves. "Under the consulship of Venantius and Kella," says a grave bishop, "the people of Alexandria and all Egypt were seized with a strange and diabolical frenzy. Great and small, slaves and freedmen, monks and clergy, the natives of the land who opposed the Synod of Chalcedon, lost their speech and reason, barked like dogs, and tore with their own teeth the flesh from their hands and arms. The disorders of 30 years at length produced the famous Henoticon of the Emperor Zeno, which in his reign and in that of Anastasius was signed by all the bishops of the East under the penalty of degradation and exile if they rejected or infringed this salutary and fundamental law. The clergy may smile or groan at the presumption of a layman who defines the articles of faith. Yet if he stoops to the humiliating task, his mind is less infected by prejudice or interest, and the authority of the magistrate can only be maintained by the concord of the people. It is in ecclesiastical story that Zeno appears least contemptible, and I am not able to discern any Manichaean or Eutychian guilt in the generous saying of Anastasius, that it was unworthy of an emperor to persecute the worshippers of Christ and the citizens of Rome. The Henoticon was most pleasing to the Egyptians, yet the smallest blemish has not been described by the jealous and even jaundiced eyes of our Orthodox schoolmen, and it accurately represents the Catholic faith of the Incarnation without adopting or disclaiming the peculiar terms of tenets of the hostile sects. A solemn anathema is pronounced against Nestorius and Eutyches, against all heretics by whom Christ is divided or confounded or reduced to a phantom. Without defining the number or the article of the word nature, the pure system of St. Cyril, the faith of Nice, Constantinople, and Ephesus is respectfully confirmed. But instead of bowing at the name of the Fourth Council, the subject is dismissed by the censure of all contrary doctrines, if any such have been taught, either elsewhere or at Chalcedon. Under this ambiguous expression, the friends and the enemies of the last synod might unite in a silent embrace. The most reasonable Christians acquiesced in this mode of toleration, but their reason was feeble and inconstant, and their obedience was despised as timid and servile by the vehement spirit of their brethren. On a subject which engrossed the thoughts and discourses of men, it was difficult to preserve an exact neutrality. A book, a sermon, a prayer rekindled the flame of controversy, and the bonds of communion were alternately broken and renewed by the private animosity of the bishops. The space between Nestorius and Eutyches was filled by 1,000 shades of language and opinion. The Acephali of Egypt and the Roman pontiffs, of equal valor, though of unequal strength, may be found at the two extremities of a theological scale. The Acephali, without a king or a bishop, was separated above 300 years from the patriarchs of Alexandria, who had accepted the communion of Constantinople, without exacting a formal condemnation of the Synod of Chalcedon. For accepting the communion of Alexandria without a formal approbation of the same synod, the patriarchs of Constantinople were anathematized by the popes. Their inflexible despotism involved the most orthodox of the Greek churches in this spiritual contagion, denied or doubted the validity of their sacraments, and fomented 35 years the schism of the East and West, till they finally abolished the memory of 4 Byzantine pontiffs who had dared to oppose the supremacy of St. Peter. Before that period, the precarious truce of Constantinople and Egypt had been violated by the zeal of the rival prelates. Macedonius, who was suspected of the Nestorian heresy, asserted, in disgrace and exile, the Synod of Chalcedon, while the successor of Cyril would have purchased its overthrow with a bribe of 2,000 pounds of gold. In the fever of the times, the sense, or rather the sound, of a syllable was sufficient to disturb the peace of an empire. The Trisagion, thrice holy, 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 Lord God of hosts, is supposed by the Greeks to be the identical hymn which the angels and cherubim eternally repeat before the throne of God, and which, about the middle of the 5th century, was miraculously revealed to the Church of Constantinople. The devotion of Antioch soon added, "Who was crucified for us," and this grateful address, either to Christ alone or to the whole Trinity, may be justified by the rules of theology, and has been gradually adopted by the Catholics of the East and West. But it had been imagined by a monophysite bishop. The gift of an enemy was at first rejected as a dire and dangerous blasphemy. A rash innovation had nearly cost the Emperor Anastasius his throne and his life. The people of Constantinople was devoid of any rational principles of freedom, but they held, as a lawful cause of rebellion, the colour of a livery in the races, or the colour of a mystery in the schools. The Trisagion, with and without this obnoxious addition, was chanted in the cathedral by two adverse choirs, and when their lungs were exhausted, they had recourse to the more solid arguments of sticks and stones. The aggressors were punished by the emperor and defended by the patriarch, and the crown and mitre were staked on the event of this momentous quarrel. The streets were instantly crowded with innumerable swarms of men, women, and children. The legions of monks in regular array marched and shouted and fought at their head. "Christians, this is the day of martyrdom. Let us not desert our spiritual father. Anathema to the Manichaean tyrant. He is unworthy to reign." Such was the Catholic cry, and the galleys of Anastasius lay upon their oars before the palace till the patriarch had pardoned his penitent and hushed the waves of the troubled multitude. The triumph of Macedonius was checked by speedy exile, but the zeal of his flock was again exasperated by the same question, whether one of the Trinity had been crucified. On this momentous occasion, the blue and green factions of Constantinople suspended their discord, and the civil and military powers were annihilated in their presence. The keys of the city and the standards of the guards were deposited in the Forum of Constantine, the principal station and camp of the faithful. Day and night they were incessantly busied either in singing hymns to the honour of their god or in pillaging and murdering the servants of their prince. The head of his favourite monk, the friend, as they styled him, of the enemy of the Holy Trinity, was borne aloft on a spear, and the firebrands which had been darted against heretical structures diffused the undistinguishing flames over the most orthodox buildings. The statues of the emperor were broken, and his person was concealed in a suburb, till, at the end of 3 days, he dared to implore the mercy of his subjects. Without his diadem, and in the posture of a suppliant, Anastasius appeared on the throne of the circus. The Catholics, before his face, rehearsed their genuine Trisagion. They exulted in the offer which he proclaimed by the voice of a herald of abdicating the purple. They listened to the admonition that, since all could not reign, they should previously agree in the choice of a sovereign, and they accepted the blood of 2 unpopular ministers whom their master, without hesitation, condemned to the lions. These furious but transient seditions were encouraged by the success of Vitalian, who, with an army of Huns and Bulgarians, for the most part idolaters, declared himself the champion of the Catholic faith. In this pious rebellion he depopulated Thrace, besieged Constantinople, exterminated 65,000 of his fellow Christians, till he obtained the recall of the bishops, the satisfaction of the Pope, and the establishment of the Council of Chalcedon, an orthodox treaty, reluctantly signed by the dying Anastasius, and more faithfully performed by the uncle of Justinian. And such was the event of the first of the religious wars, which have been waged in the name and by the disciples of the God of Peace. Justinian has been already seen in the various lights of a prince, a conqueror, and a lawgiver. The theologian still remains, and it affords an unfavourable prejudice that his theology should form a very prominent feature of his portrait. The sovereign sympathized with his subjects and their superstitious reverence for living and departed saints. His code, and more especially his novels, confirm and enlarge the privileges of the clergy, and at every dispute between a monk and a layman, the partial judge was inclined to pronounce that truth and innocence and justice were always on the side of the church. In his public and private devotions, the emperor was assiduous and exemplary. His prayers, vigils, and fasts displayed the austere penance of a monk. His fancy was amused by the hope or belief of personal inspiration. He had secured the patronage of the Virgin and Saint Michael, the archangel, and his recovery from a dangerous disease was ascribed to the miraculous succour of the holy martyrs, Cosmas and Damian. The capital and the provinces of the East were decorated with the monuments of his religion. And though the far greater part of these costly structures may be attributed to his taste or ostentation, the zeal of the royal architect was probably quickened by a genuine sense of love and gratitude towards his invisible benefactors. Among the titles of imperial greatness, the name of Pius was most pleasing to his ear. To promote the temporal and spiritual interest of the church was the serious business of his life. And the duty of father of his country was often sacrificed to that of defender of the faith. The controversies of the times were congenial to his temper and understanding, and the theological professors must inwardly deride the diligence of a stranger who cultivated their art and neglected his own. "What can ye fear," said a bold conspirator to his associates, "from your bigoted tyrant? Sleepless and unarmed, he sits whole nights in his closet, debating with reverend greybeards and turning over the pages of ecclesiastical volumes." The fruits of these lucubrations were displayed in many a conference, where Justinian might shine as the loudest and most subtle of the disputants. In many a sermon, which, under the name of edicts and epistles, proclaimed to the empire the theology of their master. While the barbarians invaded the provinces, while the victorious legion marched under the banners of Belisarius and Narses, the successor of Trajan, unknown to the camp, was content to vanquish at the head of a synod. Had he invited to these synods a disinterested and rational spectator, Justinian might have learned that religious controversy is the offspring of arrogance and folly, that true piety is most laudably expressed by silence and submission, that man, ignorant of his own nature, should not presume to scrutinize the nature of his God, and that it is sufficient for us to know that power and benevolence are the perfect attributes of the deity. Toleration was not the virtue of the times, and indulgence to rebels has seldom been the virtue of princes. But when the prince descends to the narrow and peevish character of a disputant, he is easily provoked to supply the defect of argument by the plenitude of power, and to chastise without mercy the perverse blindness of those who willfully shut their eyes against the light of demonstration. The reign of Justinian was a uniform yet various scene of persecution, and he appears to have surpassed his indolent predecessors both in the contrivance of his laws and the rigor of their execution. The insufficient term of 3 months was assigned for the conversion or exile of all heretics, and if he still connived at their precarious stay, they were deprived, under his iron yoke, not only of the benefits of society, but of the common birthright of men and Christians. At the end of 400 years, the Montanists of Phrygia still breathed the wild enthusiasm of perfection and prophecy which they had imbibed from their male and female apostles, the special organs of the Paraclete. On the approach of the Catholic priests and soldiers, They grasped with alacrity the crown of martyrdom. The conventicle and the congregation perished in the flames. But these primitive fanatics were not extinguished 300 years after the death of their tyrant. Under the protection of their Gothic confederates, the Church of the Arians at Constantinople had braved the severity of the laws. Their clergy equaled the wealth and magnificence of the Senate, and the gold and silver which were seized by the rapacious hand of Justinian might perhaps be claimed as the spoils of the provinces and the trophies of the barbarians. A secret remnant of pagans, who still lurked in the most refined and most rustic conditions of mankind, excited the indignation of the Christians, who were, perhaps, unwilling that any strangers should be the witnesses of their intestine quarrels. A bishop was named as the Inquisitor of the Faith, and his diligence soon discovered in the court and city the magistrates, lawyers, physicians, and sophists who still cherished the superstition of the Greeks. They were sternly informed that they must choose, without delay, between the displeasure of Jupiter or Justinian, and that their aversion to the gospel could no longer be distinguished under the scandalous mask of indifference or impiety. The patrician Photius, perhaps alone, was resolved to live and to die like his ancestors. He enfranchised himself with the stroke of a dagger, then left his tyrant the poor consolation of exposing with ignominy the lifeless corpse of the fugitive. His weaker brethren submitted to their earthly monarch, underwent the ceremony of baptism, and labored by their extraordinary zeal to erase the suspicion or to expiate the guilt of idolatry. The native country of Homer and the theater of the Trojan War still retain the last sparks of his mythology. By the care of the same bishop, 70,000 pagans were detected and converted in Asia, Phrygia, Lydia, and Caria. 96 churches were built for the new proselytes, and linen vestments, Bibles, and liturgies, and vases of gold and silver were supplied by the pious munificence of Justinian. The Jews, who had been gradually stripped of their immunities, were oppressed by a vexatious law which compelled them to observe the festival of Easter the same day on which it was celebrated by the Christians. And they might complain, with the more reason, since the Catholics themselves did not agree with the astronomical calculations of their sovereign. The people of Constantinople delayed the beginning of their Lent a whole week after it had been ordained by authority, and they had the pleasure of fasting 7 days, while meat was exposed for sale by the command of the emperor. The Samaritans of Palestine were a motley race, an ambiguous sect, rejected as Jews by the pagans, by the Jews as schismatics, and by the Christians as idolaters. The abomination of the cross had already been planted on their holy mount of Gerizim, but the persecution of Justinian offered only the alternative of baptism or rebellion. They chose the latter. Under the standard of a desperate leader, they rose in arms and retaliated their wrongs on the lives, the property, and the temples of a defenseless people. The Samaritans were finally subdued by the regular forces of the East. 20,000 were slain, 20,000 were sold by the Arabs to the infidels of Persia and India, and the remains of that unhappy nation atoned for the crime of treason and by the sin of hypocrisy. It has been computed that 100,000 Roman subjects were extirpated in the Samaritan War, which converted the once fruitful province into a desolate and smoking wilderness. But in the creed of Justinian, the guilt of murder could not be applied to the slaughter of unbelievers, and he piously labored to establish with fire and sword the unity of the Christian faith. With these sentiments, it was incumbent on him, at least, to be always in the right. In the first years of his administration, he signalized his zeal as the discipline and patron of orthodoxy. The reconciliation of the Greeks and Latins established the Tome of St. Leo as the creed of the emperor and the empire. The Nestorians and Eutychians were exposed on either side to the double edge of persecution, and the four synods of Nice, Constantinople, Ephesus, and Chalcedon were ratified by the code of a Catholic lawgiver. But while Justinian strove to maintain the uniformity of faith and worship, his wife, Theodora, whose vices were not incompatible with devotion, had listened to the Monophysite teachers. That the open or clandestine enemies of the church revived and multiplied at the smile of their gracious patroness. The capital, the palace, the nuptial bed, were torn by spiritual discord. Yet so doubtful was the sincerity of the royal consorts that their seeming disagreement was imputed by many to a secret and mischievous confederacy against the religion and happiness of their people. The famous dispute of the three chapters, which has filled more volumes than it deserves lines, is deeply marked with this subtle and disingenuous spirit. It was now 300 years since the body of Origen had been eaten by the worms. His soul, of which he held the pre-existence, was in the hands of its creator. But his writings were eagerly perused by the monks of Palestine. In these writings, the piercing eye of Justinian descried more than 10 metaphysical errors. And the primitive doctor and the company of Pythagoras and Plato was devoted by the clergy to the eternity of hellfire, which he had presumed to deny. Under the cover of this precedent, a treacherous blow was aimed at the Council of Chalcedon. The fathers had listened, without impatience, to the praise of Theodore of Mopsuestia, and their justice or indulgence had restored both Theodore of Cyrus and Ebas of Edessa to the communion of the church. But the characters of these Oriental bishops were tainted with the reproach of heresy. The first had been the master, the two others were the friends of Nestorius. Their most suspicious passages were accused under the title of the three chapters, and the condemnation of their memory must involve the honor of a synod, whose name was pronounced with sincere or affected reverence by the Catholic world. If these bishops, whether innocent or guilty, were annihilated in the sleep of death, they would not probably be awakened by the clamor which, after 100 years, was raised over their grave. If they were already in the fangs of the demon, their torments could neither be aggravated nor assuaged by human industry. If in the company of saints and angels they enjoyed the rewards of piety, they must have smiled at the idle fury of the theological insects who still crawled on the surface of the earth. The foremost of these insects, the emperor of the Romans, darted his sting and distilled his venom, perhaps without discerning the true motives of Theodora and her ecclesiastical faction. The victims were no longer subject to his power, and the vehement style of his edicts could only proclaim their damnation and invite the clergy of the East to join in a full chorus of curses and anathemas. The East, with some hesitation, consented to the voice of her sovereign. The fifth general council of 3 patriarchs and 165 bishops was held at Constantinople, and the authors as well as the defenders of the three chapters were separated from the communion of the saints and solemnly delivered to the Prince of Darkness. But the Latin churches were more jealous of the honor of Leo and the Synod of Chalcedon. And if they had fought as they usually did under the standard of Rome, they might have prevailed in the cause of reason and humanity. But their chief was a prisoner in the hands of the enemy. The throne of St. Peter, which had been disgraced by the simony, was betrayed by the cowardice of Vigilius, who yielded after a long and inconsistent struggle to the despotism of Justinian and the sophistry of the Greeks. His apostasy provoked the indignation of the Latins, and no more than 2 bishops could be found who would impose their hands on his deacon and successor, Pelagius. Yet the perseverance of the popes insensibly transferred to their adversaries the appellation of schismatics. The Illyrian, African, and Italian churches were oppressed by the civil and ecclesiastical powers, not without some effort of military force. The distant barbarians transcribed the creed of the Vatican, and in the period of a century the schism of the three chapters expired in an obscure angle of the Venetian province. But the religious discontent of the Italians had already promoted the conquests of the Lombards, and the Romans themselves were accustomed to suspect the faith and to detest the government of their Byzantine tyrant. Justinian was neither steady nor consistent in the nice process of fixing his volatile opinions and those of his subjects. In his youth he was offended by the slightest deviation from the orthodox line. In his old age he transgressed the measure of temperate heresy, and the Jacobites, not less than the Catholics, were scandalized by his declaration that the body of Christ was incorruptible, and that his manhood was never subject to any wants and infirmities, the inheritance of our mortal flesh. This fantastic opinion was announced in the last edicts of Justinian. And at the moment of his seasonable departure, the clergy had refused to subscribe, the prince was prepared to persecute, and the people were resolved to suffer or resist. The bishop of Trier, secure beyond the limits of his power, addressed the monarch of the East in the language of authority and affection. "Most gracious Justinian, remember your baptism and your creed. Let not your grey hairs be defiled with heresy. Recall your fathers from exile and your followers from perdition. You cannot be ignorant that Italy and Gaul, Spain and Africa already deplore your fall and anathematize your name. Unless, without delay, you destroy what you have taught. Unless you exclaim with a loud voice, 'I have erred, I have sinned. Anathema to Nestorius, anathema to Eutyches,' you deliver your soul to the same flames in which they will eternally burn." He died and made no sign. His death restored in some degree the peace of the church and the reigns of his four successors, Justin Tiberius, Maurice, and Phocas, are distinguished by a rare, though fortunate, vacancy in the ecclesiastical history of the East. The faculties of sense and reason are least capable of acting on themselves. The eye is most inaccessible to the sight, the soul to the thought. Yet we think, and even feel, that one will, a sole principle of action, is essential to a rational and conscious being. When Heraclius returned from the Persian War, the orthodox hero consulted his bishops whether the Christ, whom he adored, of one person, but of two natures, was actuated by a single or a double will. They replied in the singular, and the emperor was encouraged to hope that the Jacobites of Egypt and Syria might be reconciled by the profession of a doctrine most certainly harmless and most probably true, since it was taught even by the Nestorians themselves. The experiment was tried without effect, and the timid or vehement Catholics condemned even the semblance of a retreat in the presence of a subtle and audacious enemy. The Orthodox, the prevailing party, devised new modes of speech and argument and interpretation. To either nature of Christ they speciously applied a proper and distinct energy, but the difference was no longer visible when they allowed that the human and the divine will were invariably the same. The disease was attended with the customary symptoms. But the Greek clergy, as if satiated with the endless controversy of the Incarnation, instilled a healing counsel into the ear of the prince and people. They declared themselves monotheolites, asserters of the unity of will. But they treated the words as new, the questions as superfluous, and recommended a religious silence as the most agreeable to the prudence and charity of the gospel. This law of silence was successively imposed by the ekthesis, or exposition of Heraclius, the type or model of his grandson Constance. Then the imperial edicts were subscribed with alacrity or reluctance by the four patriarchs of Rome, Constantinople, Alexandria, and Antioch. But the bishop and monks of Jerusalem sounded the alarm. In the language, or even in the silence of the Greeks, the Latin churches detected a latent heresy, and the obedience of Pope Honorius to the commands of his sovereign was retracted and censured by the bolder ignorance of his successors. They condemned the execrable and abominable heresy of the Monothelites, who revived the errors of Manes, Apollinaris, Eutyches, etc. They signed the sentence of excommunication on the tomb of Saint Peter. The ink was mingled with the sacramental wine, the blood of Christ, and no ceremony was omitted that could fill the superstitious mind with horror and affright. As the representative of the Western Church, Pope Martin and his Lateran Synod anathematized the perfidious and guilty silence of the Greeks. 105 bishops of Italy, for the most part the subjects of Constance, presumed to reprobate his wicked type and the impious ekthesis of his grandfather, and to confound the authors and their adherents with the 21 notorious heretics, the apostates from the church, and the organs of the devil. Such an insult under the tamest reign could not pass with impunity. Pope Martin ended his days on the inhospitable shore of the Tauric Chersonesus, and his oracle, the abbot Maximus, was inhumanly chastised by the amputation of his tongue and his right hand. But the same invincible spirit survived in their successors, and the triumph of the Latins avenged their recent defeat and obliterated the disgrace of the three chapters. The synods of Rome were confirmed by the 6th General Council of Constantinople in the palace and the presence of a new Constantine, a descendant of Heraclius. The royal convert converted the Byzantine pontiff and a majority of the bishops. The dissenters, with their chief, Macarius of Antioch, were condemned to the spiritual and temporal pains of heresy. The East condescended to accept the lessons of the West, and the creed was finally settled, which teaches the Catholics of every age that two wills or energies are harmonized in the person of Christ. The majesty of the Pope and the Roman Synod was represented by two priests, one deacon and three bishops. But these obscure Latins had neither arms to compel, nor treasures to bribe, nor language to persuade. And I am ignorant by what arts they could determine the lofty emperor of the Greeks to abjure the catechism of his infancy, and to persecute the religion of his fathers. Perhaps the monks and people of Constantinople were favorable to the Lateran Creed, which is indeed the least reasonable of the two. And the suspicion is countenanced by the unnatural moderation of the Greek clergy, who appear in this quarrel to be conscious of their weakness. While the synod debated, a fanatic proposed a more summary decision by raising a dead man to life. The prelates assisted at the trial, but the acknowledged failure may serve to indicate that the passions and prejudices of the multitude were not enlisted on the side of the Monothelites. In the next generation, when the son of Constantine was deposed and slain by the disciple of Macarius, they tasted the feast of revenge and dominion. The image or monument of the Sixth Council was defaced, and the original acts were committed to the flames. But in the second year, their patron was cast headlong from the throne. The bishops of the East were released from their occasional conformity. The Roman faith was more firmly replanted by the orthodox successors of Bardanes, and the fine problems of the Incarnation were forgotten in the more popular and visible quarrel of the worship of images. Before the end of the 7th century, the creed of the Incarnation, which had been defined at Rome and Constantinople, was uniformly preached in the remote islands of Britain and Ireland. The same ideas were entertained, or rather the same words were repeated, by all the Christians whose liturgy was performed in the Greek or the Latin tongue. Their numbers and visible splendour bestowed an imperfect claim to the appellation of Catholics. But in the East they were marked with the less honourable name of Melkites, or Royalists, of men whose faith, instead of resting on the basis of Scripture, reason, or tradition, had been established and was still maintained by the arbitrary power of a temporal monarch. Their adversaries might allege the words of the fathers of Constantinople, who professed themselves the slaves of the king, and they might relate with malicious joy how the decrees of Chalcedon had been inspired and reformed by the Emperor Marcian and his virgin bride. The prevailing faction will naturally inculcate the duty of submission, nor is it less natural that dissenters should feel and assert the principles of freedom. Under the rod of persecution, the Nestorians and Monophysites degenerated into rebels and fugitives, and the most ancient and useful allies of Rome were taught to consider the emperor not as the chief, but as the enemy of the Christians. Language, the leading principle which unites or separates the tribes of mankind, soon discriminated the sectaries of the East by a peculiar and perpetual bridge, which abolished the means of intercourse and the hope of reconciliation. The long dominion of the Greeks, their colonies, and above all their eloquence, had propagated a language doubtless the most perfect that has been contrived by the art of man. Yet the body of the people, both in Syria and Egypt, still persevered in the use of their national idioms. With this difference, however, that the Coptic was confined to the rude and illiterate peasants of the Nile, while the Syriac, from the mountains of Assyria to the Red Sea, was adapted to the higher topics of poetry and argument. Armenia and Abyssinia were infected by the speech or learning of the Greeks, and their barbaric tongues, which have been revived in the studies of modern Europe, were unintelligible to the inhabitants of the Roman Empire. The Syriac and the Coptic, the Armenian and the Ethiopic, are consecrated in the service of their respective churches, and their theology is enriched by domestic versions, both of the Scriptures and of the most popular fathers. After a period of 1,360 years, the spark of controversy first kindled by a sermon of Nestorius still burns in the bosom of the East, and the hostile communions still maintain the faith and discipline of their founders. In the most abject state of ignorance, poverty, and servitude, the Nestorians and Monophysites reject the spiritual supremacy of Rome, and cherish the toleration of their Turkish masters, which allows them to anathematize, on the one hand, St. Cyril and the Synod of Ephesus, on the other, Pope Leo and the Council of Chalcedon. The weight which they cast into the downfall of the Eastern Empire demands our notice, and the reader may be amused with the various prospect of 1, the Nestorians, 2, the Jacobites, 3, the Maronites, 4, the Armenians, 5, the Copts, and 6, the Abyssinians. To the 3 former, the Syriac is common, but of the latter, each is discriminated by the use of a national idiom. Yet the modern natives of Armenia and Abyssinia would be incapable of conversing with their ancestors, and the Christians of Egypt and Syria, who reject the religion, have adopted the language of the Arabians. The lapse of time has seconded the sacerdotal arts, and in the East, as well as in the West, the deity is addressed in an obsolete tongue, unknown to the majority of the congregation. Both in his native and his episcopal province, the heresy of the unfortunate Nestorius was speedily obliterated. The Oriental bishops, who at Ephesus had resisted to his face the arrogance of Cyril, were mollified by his tardy concessions. The same prelates, or their successors, subscribed, not without a murmur, the decrees of Chalcedon. The power of the Monophysites reconciled them with the Catholics in the conformity of passion, of interest, and, insensibly, of belief, and their last reluctant sigh was breathed in the defense of the three chapters. Their dissenting brethren, less moderate or more sincere, were crushed by the penal laws, and as early as the reign of Justinian it became difficult to find a church of Nestorians within the limits of the Roman Empire. Beyond those limits they had discovered a new world in which they might hope for liberty and aspire to conquest. In Persia, notwithstanding the resistance of the Magi, Christianity had struck a deep root, and the nations of the East reposed under its salutary shade. The Catholic, or primate, resided in the capital. In his synods and in their dioceses, his metropolitans, bishops, and clergy represented the pomp and order of a regular hierarchy. They rejoiced in the increase of proselytes, who were converted from the Zendavesta to the gospel, from the secular to the monastic life, and their zeal was stimulated by the presence of an artful and formidable enemy. The Persian church had been founded by the missionaries of Syria, and their language, discipline, and doctrine were closely interwoven with its original frame. The Catholics were elected and ordained by their own suffragans, but their filial dependence on the patriarchs of Antioch is attested by the canons of the Oriental Church. In the Persian school of Edessa, the rising generations of the faithful imbibed their theological idiom. They studied in the Syriac version the 10,000 volumes of Theodore of Mopsuestia, and they revered the apostolic faith and holy martyrdom of his disciple Nestorius, whose person and language were equally unknown to the nations beyond the Tigris. The first indelible lesson of Ebus, bishop of Edessa, taught them to execrate the Egyptians, who in the synod of Ephesus had impiously confounded the two natures of Christ. The flight of the masters and scholars, who were twice expelled from the Athens of Syria, dispersed a crowd of missionaries inflamed by the double zeal of religion and revenge. And the rigid unity of the Monophysites, who, under the reigns of Zeno and Anastasius, had invaded the thrones of the East, provoked their antagonists in a land of freedom to avow a moral rather than a physical union of the two persons of Christ. Since the first preaching of the gospel, the Sasanian kings beheld with an eye of suspicion a race of aliens and apostates who had embraced the religion and who might favor the cause of the hereditary foes of their country. The royal edicts had often prohibited their dangerous correspondence with the Syrian clergy. The progress of the schism was grateful to the jealous pride of Perozes, and he listened to the eloquence of an artful prelate who painted Nestorius as the friend of Persia, and urged him to secure the fidelity of his Christian subjects by granting a just preference to the victims and enemies of the Roman tyrant. The Nestorians composed a large majority of the clergy and people. They were encouraged by the smile and armed with the sword of despotism. Yet many of their weaker brethren were startled at the thought of breaking loose from the communion of the Christian world, and the blood of 7,700 Monophysites, or Catholics, confirmed the uniformity of faith and discipline in the churches of Persia. Their ecclesiastical institutions are distinguished by liberal principle of reason, or at least of policy. The austerity of the cloister was relaxed and gradually forgotten. Houses of charity were endowed for the education of orphans and foundlings. The law of celibacy, so forcibly recommended to the Greeks and Latins, was disregarded by the Persian clergy, and the number of the elect was multiplied by the public and reiterated nuptials of the priests, the bishops, and even the patriarch himself. To this standard of natural and religious freedom, myriads of fugitives resorted from all the provinces of the Eastern Empire. The narrow bigotry of Justinian was punished by the immigration of his most industrious subjects. They transported into Persia the arts both of peace and war, and those who deserved the favour were promoted in the service of a discerning monarch. The arms of Nushavan and his fiercer grandson were assisted with advice and money and troops by the desperate sectaries who still lurked in their native cities of the east. Their zeal was rewarded with the gift of the Catholic churches. But when those cities and churches were recovered by Heraclius, their open profession of treason and heresy compelled them to seek a refuge in the realm of their foreign ally. But the seeming tranquility of the Nestorians was often endangered, and sometimes overthrown. They were involved in the common evils of Oriental despotism. Their enmity to Rome could not always atone for their attachment to the gospel, and a colony of 300,000 Jacobites, the captives of Apamea and Antioch, was permitted to erect a hostile altar in the face of the Catholic, and in the sunshine of the court. In his last treaty, Justinian introduced some conditions which tended to enlarge and fortify the toleration of Christianity in Persia. The emperor, ignorant of the rights of conscience, was incapable of pity or esteem for the heretics who denied the authority of the holy synods. But he flattered himself that they would gradually perceive the temporal benefits of union with the empire and the Church of Rome. And if he failed in exciting their gratitude, he might hope to provoke the jealousy of their sovereign. In a later age, the Lutherans have been burnt at Paris and protected in Germany by the superstition and policy of the most Christian king. The desire of gaining souls for God and subjects for the Church has excited in every age the diligence of the Christian priests. From the conquest of Persia they carried their spiritual arms to the north, the east, and the south, and the simplicity of the gospel was fashioned and painted with the colors of the Syriac theology. In the 6th century, according to the report of a Nestorian traveler, Christianity was successfully preached to the Bactrians, the Huns, the Persians, the Indians, the Persarmenians, the Medes, and the Elamites. The barbaric churches, from the Gulf of Persia to the Caspian Sea, were almost infinite, and their recent faith was conspicuous in the number and sanctity of their monks and martyrs. The pepper coast of Malabar and the isles of the ocean, Socotora and Ceylon, were peopled with an increasing multitude of Christians, and the bishops and clergy of those sequestered regions derived their ordination from the Catholic of Babylon. In a subsequent age, the zeal of the Nestorians overleaped the limits which had confined the ambition and curiosity both of the Greeks and Persians. The missionaries of Balkh and Samarkand pursued without fear the footsteps of the roving Tatar and insinuated themselves into the camps of the valleys of Emmaus and the banks of the Selinga. They exposed a metaphysical creed to those illiterate shepherds. To those sanguinary warriors they recommended humanity and repose. Yet a Khan, whose power they vainly magnified, is said to have received at their hands the rites of baptism, and even of ordination, and the fame of Prester, or Prester John, has long amused the credulity of Europe. The royal convert was indulged in the use of a portable altar, but he dispatched an embassy to the patriarch to inquire how, in the season of Lent, he should abstain from animal food, and how he might celebrate the Eucharist in a desert that produced neither corn nor wine. In their progress by sea and land, the Nestorians entered China by the port of Canton and the northern residence of Sigun. Unlike the senators of Rome, who assumed with a smile the characters of priests and augurs, the mandarins, who affect in public the reason of philosophers, are devoted in private to every mode of popular superstition. They cherished and they confounded the gods of Palestine and of India, but the propagation of Christianity awakened the jealousy of the state, and after a short vicissitude of favor and persecution, the foreign sect expired in ignorance and oblivion. Under the reign of the caliphs, the Nestorian church was diffused from China to Jerusalem and Cyrus, and their numbers, with those of the Jacobites, were computed to surpass the Greek and Latin communions. 25 metropolitans, or archbishops, composed their hierarchy, but several of these were dispensed by the distance and danger of the way from the duty of personal attendance on the easy condition that every 6 years they should testify their faith and obedience to the Catholic or Patriarch of Babylon. A vague appellation which has been successively applied to the royal seats of Seleucia, Ctesiphon, and Baghdad. These remote branches are long since withered, and the old patriarchal trunk is now divided by the Elijahs of Mosul, the representatives almost on lineal descent of the genuine and primitive succession, the Josephs of Amida, who are reconciled to the Church of Rome, and the Simeons of Van, or Ormia, whose revolt at the head of 40,000 families was promoted in the 16th century by the Sophists of Persia. The number of 300,000 is allowed for the whole body of the Nestorians who, under the name of Chaldeans, or Assyrians, are confounded with the most learned or the most powerful nation of Eastern antiquity. According to the legend of antiquity, the gospel was preached in India by St. Thomas. At the end of the 9th century, his shrine, perhaps in the neighbourhood of Madras, was devoutly visited by the ambassadors of Alfred, and their return with a cargo of pearls and spices rewarded the zeal of the English monarch, who entertained the largest projects of trade and discovery. When the Portuguese first opened the navigation of India, the Christians of St. Thomas had been seated for ages on the coast of Malabar, and the difference of their character and colour attested the mixture of a foreign race. In arms, in arts, and possibly in virtue, they excelled the natives of Hindustan. The husbandmen cultivated the palm tree. The merchants were enriched by the pepper trade. The soldiers preceded the Nairs, or nobles, of Malabar, and their hereditary privileges were respected by the gratitude or the fear of the King of Cochin and the Zamorin himself. They acknowledged a gentoo of sovereign, but they were governed, even in temporal concerns, by the Bishop of Angamala. He still asserted his ancient title of Metropolitan of India, but his real jurisdiction was exercised in 1,400 churches, and he was entrusted with the care of 200,000 souls. Their religion would have rendered them the firmest and most cordial allies of the Portuguese. But the inquisitors soon discerned in the Christians of St. Thomas the unpardonable guilt of heresy and schism. Instead of owning themselves the subjects of the Roman pontiff, the spiritual and temporal monarch of the globe, they adhered, like their ancestors, to the communion of the Nestorian patriarch, and the bishops whom he ordained at Mosul traversed the dangers of the sea and land to reach their diocese on the coast of Malabar. In their Syriac liturgy, the names of Theodore and Nestorius were piously commemorated. They united their adoration of the two persons of Christ. The title of Mother of God was offensive to their ear, and they measured with scrupulous avarice the honors of the Virgin Mary, whom the superstition of the Latins had almost exalted to the rank of a goddess. When her image was first presented to the disciples of St. Thomas, they indignantly exclaimed, "We are Christians, not idolaters." And their simple devotion was content with the veneration of the cross. Their separation from the Western world had left them in ignorance of the improvements, or corruptions, of 1,000 years, and their conformity with the faith and practice of the 5th century would equally disappoint the prejudices of a papist or a Protestant. It was the first care of the ministers of Rome to intercept all correspondence with the Nestorian patriarch, and several of his bishops expired in the prisons of the Holy Office. The flock, without a shepherd, was assaulted by the power of the Portuguese, the arts of the Jesuits, and the zeal of Alexis de Menezes, Archbishop of Goa, in his personal visitation of the coast of Malabar. The synod of Diampa, at which he presided, consummated the pious work of the reunion, and rigorously imposed the doctrine and discipline of the Roman Church, without forgetting auricular confession, the strongest engine of ecclesiastical torture. The memory of Theodore and Nestorius was condemned, and Malabar was reduced under the dominion of the Pope, of the Primate, and of the Jesuits, who invaded the see of Angamala, or Cranganore. 60 years of servitude and hypocrisy were patiently endured, but as soon as the Portuguese Empire was shaken by the courage and industry of the Dutch, the Nestorians asserted with vigor and effect the religion of their fathers. The Jesuits were incapable of defending the power which they had abused. The arms of 40,000 Christians were pointed against their falling tyrants, and the Indian archdeacon assumed the character of bishop till a fresh supply of episcopal gifts and Syriac missionaries could be obtained from the Patriarch of Babylon. Since the expulsion of the Portuguese, the Nestorian creed is freely professed on the coast of Malabar. The trading companies of Holland and England are the friends of toleration, but if oppression be less mortifying than contempt, the Christians of St. Thomas have reason to complain of the cold and silent indifference of their brethren of Europe. The history of the Monophysites is less copious and interesting than that of the Nestorians. Under the reigns of Zeno and Anastasius, their artful leaders surprised the ear of the prince, usurped the thrones of the East, and crushed on its native soil the school of the Syrians. The rule of the Monophysite faith was defined with exquisite discretion by Severus, Patriarch of Antioch. He condemned in the style of the Henoticon the adverse heresies of Nestorius, and Eutyches maintained against the latter the reality of the body of Christ, and constrained the Greeks to allow that he was a liar who spoke the truth. But the approximation of ideas could not abate the vehemence of passion. Each party was the more astonished that their blind antagonist could dispute on so trifling a difference. The tyrant of Syria enforced the belief of his creed, and his reign was polluted with the blood of 350 monks, who were slain, not perhaps without provocation or resistance, under the walls of Apamea. The successor of Anastasius replanted the Orthodox standard in the East. Severus fled into Egypt, and his friend, the eloquent Zenias, who had escaped from the Nestorians of Persia, was suffocated in his exile by the Melchites of Paphlagonia. 54 bishops were swept from their thrones, 800 ecclesiastics were cast into prison, and notwithstanding the ambiguous favor of Theodora, the Oriental flocks, deprived of their shepherds, must insensibly have been either famished or poisoned. In this spiritual distress, the expiring faction was revived and united and perpetuated by the labors of a monk, and the name of James Baradius has been preserved in the appellation of Jacobites, a familiar sound which may startle the ear of an English reader. From the holy confessors in their prison of Constantinople, he received the powers of Bishop of Edessa and Apostle of the East, and the ordination of 40,000 bishops, priests, and deacons is derived from the same inexhaustible source. The speed of the zealous missionary was promoted by the fleetest dromedaries of a devout chief of the Arabs. The doctrine and discipline of the Jacobites were secretly established in the dominions of Justinian, and each Jacobite was compelled to violate the laws and to hate the Roman legislator. the successors of Severus, while they lurked in convents or villages, while they sheltered their prescribed heads in the caverns of hermits or the tents of the Saracens, still asserted, as they now assert, their indefeasible right to the title, the rank, and the prerogatives of Patriarch of Antioch. Under the milder yoke of the infidels, they reside about a league from Merdin, in the pleasant monastery of Zafaran, which they have embellished with cells, aqueducts, and plantations. The secondary, though honourable place, is filled by the Mafrian, who in his station at Mosul itself defies the Nestorian Catholic with whom he contests the primacy of the East. Under the Patriarch and the Mafrian, 150 archbishops and bishops have been counted in the different ages of the Jacobite Church. But the order of the hierarchy is relaxed or dissolved, and the greater part of their dioceses is confined to the neighbourhood of the Euphrates and the Tigris. The cities of Aleppo and Amida, which are often visited by the Patriarch, contain some wealthy merchants and industrious mechanics. But the multitude derive their scanty sustenance from their daily labour, and poverty as well as superstition may impose their excessive fasts. 5 annual Lents, during which both the clergy and laity abstain not only from flesh or eggs, but even from the taste of wine, of oil, and of fish. Their present numbers are esteemed from 50 to 80,000 souls, the remnant of a populous church which was gradually decreased under the impression of 12 centuries. Yet in that long period, some strangers of merit have been converted to the Monophysite faith, and a Jew was the father of Abulpharagius, primate of the East, so truly eminent both in his life and death. In his life he was an elegant writer of the Syriac and Arabic tongues, a poet, physician, and historian, a subtle philosopher, and a moderate divine. In his death, his funeral was attended by his rival, the Nestorian Patriarch, with a train of Greeks and Armenians, who forgot their disputes and mingled their tears over the grave of an enemy. The sect, which was honoured by the virtues of Abulpharagius, appears, however, to sink below the level of their Nestorian brethren. The superstition of the Jacobites is more abject, their fasts more rigid, their intestine divisions are more numerous, and their doctors, as far as I can measure the degrees of nonsense, are more remote from the precincts of reason. Something may possibly be allowed for the rigor of the Monophysite theology, much more for the superior influence of the monastic order. In Syria, in Egypt, in Ethiopia, the Jacobite monks have ever been distinguished by the austerity of their penance and the absurdity of their legends. Alive or dead, they are worshipped as the favorites of the deity. The crosier of bishop and patriarch is reserved for their venerable hands, and they assume the government of men while they are yet reeking with the habits and prejudices of the cloister. In the style of the Oriental Christians, the Monothelites of every age are described under the appellation of Maronites, a name which has been insensibly transferred from a hermit to a monastery, from a monastery to a nation. Maron, a saint or savage of the 5th century, displayed his religious madness in Syria. The rival cities of Apamea and Emesa disputed his relics. A stately church was erected on his tomb, and 600 of his disciples united their solitary cells on the banks of the Orontes. In the controversies of the Incarnation, they nicely threaded the orthodox line between the sects of Nestorians and Eutyches. But the unfortunate question of one will or operation in the two natures of Christ was generated by their curious leisure. Their proselyte, the Emperor Heraclius, was rejected as a Maronite from the walls of Emesa,